Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today, we continue our series of presidential primary 2020 candidate forums. And for this show on Friday, January 3rd, we're talking with Democratic presidential candidate Cory Booker. He's with us before a live audience in NHPR's Studio D. We've been hearing from listeners throughout this campaign season. We'll be incorporating their questions and concerns into our conversation today, too. So thank you to everybody who took the time to write in. Also, I'm joined by NHPR's senior political reporter, Josh Rogers. Josh, thank you, and Senator Booker, welcome, and let's begin.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Late yesterday, a U.S. airstrike in Baghdad, I know you've been talking about this, Senator Booker, killed Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani, top Iranian figure associated with a large network of Iran-backed armed groups across the Middle East. The Pentagon has called this a defensive action, claiming the general was actively developing plans to attack Americans throughout the region. You said on MSNBC that Soleimani had American blood on his hands. I'm quoting you there. But you also criticized President Trump for lacking a strategic plan when it comes to Iran, when it comes to making this region safe. Here's my question for you, Senator Booker. What would your strategy be as president? Never mind what you might have done differently leading up to this day from President Trump. You're in the Oval Office. You inherited this. What does a President Booker do?
Well, again, understand that this is going to be unfolding. The next president is not going to take over until 1 year and about 18 days from now. And we are in a crisis. And we have been for some time. Iran's influence in that region has grown significantly under this president. Army Houthis and proxy war in Yemen, a highway and influence in Syria, arming the Lebanese, arming Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas, now growing in their influence with China and Russia. They just did naval operations together. Under this president, this region has become less safe. And unfortunately, tremendously more of a threat to our nation and our allies.
So what does a President Booker do differently?
Well, the first and foremost is you end this, what President Trump calls America First, is really America isolated and America alone. Remember, this action we just took, there's a lot of strategic implications. He's put our allies at greater potential risk. And so number one is when he pulls out of the Iran deal, he isolates this country against our own allies. So any of the complicated problems in that region, we need to have strong alliances and a larger strategic plan that has to involve diplomacy. We have our own general saying, for example, in Afghanistan, these conflicts are not going to be solved by the military. We must have diplomacy. But yet this president, time and time again, has chosen to shun diplomacy with this kind of impulse-driven bravado that he can somehow solve these hotspots on the globe, from North Korea to Iran and beyond.
I'm trying to get a sense, Senator Booker, of what you would do differently. So you say diplomacy. So can you be a little bit clearer about that?
I want to say this. It is a larger strategic approach when you first talk about the importance of our alliances and relationships. The Obama administration built part of their strategy was having diplomatic relations. So when the Iranians seized a ship and our sailors, John Kerry was able to end that crisis within 24 hours because of our growing diplomatic relations with the Iranians. We sat at a negotiating table, built out an anti-nuclear deal. This is all coming from working with alliances over time and building the kind of relationships that reduce tensions. That will be a very important part of my overall strategic plan. And so this is not just what he seems to be doing, which is a series of tactics woven together and interwoven with that as impulses, Middle East policy done by tweet, surprising your own generals. This is a larger strategic reliance on alliances, on diplomacies, on deconfliction in that region.
Still, the president's job is to protect Americans from foreign threats, and the Pentagon does say that this general was actively developing plans to attack Americans in the region. You said American blood is on his hands. You said he was responsible for killing and wounding Americans. So could this have been something that a President Booker might have done if he knew that this person was indeed planning further attacks on American citizens?
We should be careful about hypotheticals. There will be a lot of intelligence information coming out. And obviously, as my colleagues in the Senate, the Foreign Relations Committee, our staffs are already engaged. We're going to evaluate the intelligence reports as it comes out. But these are things that we know are clear. Not only have we had opportunities to have strikes on Soleimani in the past, so have the Israelis, but no one's chosen to do it because clearly he's been responsible for Quds forces. I can go through a long litany of things that this person is responsible for. But we also have to look at it in the larger strategic context. And that's what I worry about this president. He has not shown an ability to have strategic thinking about how to deconflict that region, how to support our allies, how to keep Americans safe.
Since you mentioned you sit on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, what, if anything, do you think, Senator Booker, Congress should be doing right now to address this escalation of tension, to address the possible repercussions from this attack? I'm asking you to put on your U.S. senator hat now.
In a conflict like this, you don't take it off, frankly.
Sure.
I was up. This is the reason why I joked with you about being so tired. Is I was up till late last night, woke up early this morning to work on this conflict already. Look, the great thing I have to say about working in the Senate, and this is a theme of, frankly, my campaign without my Senate hat on, is the ability to work across the aisle on critical issues in foreign policy. The Foreign Relations Committee, we actually have a long record now of rebuking President Trump in critical areas. And so whether it was another Iranian-involved crisis, which was Yemen, where most Americans don't know this, this is again, and this isn't just a partisan thing because the growth of the presidency in terms of its erosion of separation of powers, remember, war powers belong to Congress, not the president.
Many say Congress has sort of handed this over to the president, not just this president, but other presidents. This is a long, steady trend.
And I that's exactly why I'm saying this is not a partisan issue. This is a dangerous slide, which has led to presidents like President Trump. Did we declare war? Did Congress declare war on the Assad regime? No. But yet we had missile strikes on the Assad regime. Have we declared war in Yemen? No. But yet our military planes were refueling Saudi bombers to drop American bombs on Yemen, which has led to a crisis there of monumental humanitarian proportions. And so this Congress has worked in a bipartisan way, our Foreign Relations Committee, to rebuke the president on a number of times. And so, yeah, we will be working together, I hope, to look at this not in a political context, but in what is in the true national security interest of this nation. And understand this. I've been to Baghdad. I've met with our military leaders there. This is a delicate situation going on. There's a lot more information we must know. What were our communications with the Iraqis? What does this mean for our relationships with Iraq right now? There are consequences in this that need to be thought through strategically to look at this in a larger context. Again, we have invested tremendous amounts of blood and treasure in Iraq. And this is a situation where I want to see, if I was President of the United States, I'd be working to bring our troops home. What is this action now going to do? We've already seen protests at our embassy from the rise in tensions over the last number of days. This is a very serious situation. A lot of questions need to be asked of this administration, and we will be doing this in the United States Senate.
But do you consider the act itself, the strike, an act of war?
Again, there are important facts to come out, but I'm a big believer that we are not at war with Iraq, and therefore there are legal standards that should be met before a president makes a decision like that. That's why we talk about an authorization of the use of military force. That's why there is a tremendous amount of law and frankly, judicial decisions around this issue. And so I want to find out, part of the things I'll be demanding as a United States senator, is what are the intelligence reports that led you to take this action? Did this meet the standards of using military force? And this is a president, in my opinion, who has violated those separation of powers, who has not been, he's relying, like other presidents have, on a 2001 authorization of military force to do military actions now that are spreading across the globe from Africa to the Middle East. We are seeing an expansion of presidential power in a way that is very troublesome to me.
One more question for you on this, Senator Booker, and then I'm going to turn it over to Josh. You mentioned repercussions around the region on our allies. As you know, Israel is on high alert after this attack. What is the American responsibility if Israel is harmed as a result of this killing?
Israel is a critical and indispensable ally. We work in very close partnership with them. And again, these are important questions. Did we even notify the Israelis that we were taking this action? And so we know, I believe Israel is far, before this attack even happened, in a far more vulnerable position. Israel has been doing strikes in Syria. Why? Because of Iranian activities in Syria. The Hezbollah, my last trip in that region was to Lebanon to talk to Lebanese leaders in their military about the sophisticated weapons that Hezbollah now has and has been being armed under this administration. So our ally Israel is in more dangerous position. We have an obligation to stand with our ally in their defense, and this is going to raise a lot more unfortunate challenges to Israel as a result of this action.
Well, it's an evolving situation, and I want to turn to Josh Rogers now to cover some of the other issues that you've been talking about in this campaign, Senator Booker. So, Josh,
All right, so we're going to turn to some domestic policy issues and guns. Among other things, Senator, you've called for a gun licensing program and mandatory buyback programs for certain weapons that goes beyond what Democrats have traditionally referred to as common sense gun reforms. You know, given the reality that the country's had mass shooting events going on regularly for years now and that gun policies haven't changed, how would you get those policies, which go beyond what have been proposed and never gained traction in Congress, how would you get those through?
So first of all, I just want to contextualize this because you say mass shootings, but me and millions of Americans live in neighborhoods where every day, every week, we are seeing constant shootings going on. I came out of Des Moines before I came here. Another minority boy, 14-year-old, was killed. On my block where I live in Newark, Shahad Smith was killed with an assault rifle. We have an awful reality where we see young men, often minority men, the majority of homicides in America, majority of homicides are black men, black boys. This is not before I even get to a policy, a tab on my website, this is an issue for me that in my community, when we have 4th of July, where we should be celebrating America, I get parents telling me about the trauma of their children hiding under beds, showing signs of post-traumatic stress. So there is nobody that's been in that White House that will have more of a sense of urgency on this issue, of lived experience, of literally watching a child bleed to death than me. And my whole career has been about finding ways to get things done by raising the moral imagination of a nation. How do we get civil rights legislation passed? The longest filibuster in Senate history was Strom Thurmond. And we didn't pass that because of some kind of great legislative tactics. We passed it because we got the whole country involved by artists of activism that raised the conscience of this country, that fought and actually got over those filibusters. And so my career, let's just be clear, when I was a city council person, I did a hunger strike in an area that nobody paid attention to. Highway cut right over those projects into the wealthiest areas of our country. Did a hunger strike to attract attention. Thousands of people came. Police officers from suburban towns came down to help protect people. When I was mayor of the city of Newark, I found creative ways to bring attention to problems because I couldn't even get foundations or developers to come to my city.
So what would you envision as president?
Well, again, I'm not
going
to tell you all my tactics, but I'm going to tell you this. I'm not going to play by the rules that past presidents who failed to pass gun legislation have played. President Trump breaks our norms. He does it to demean, degrade, divide. He uses his social media platforms in creative ways that pits Americans against each other. I'm the person in this race that has a record of getting things done that people say can't get done, like criminal justice reform that Democrats told me because of the specter of Willie Horton, that you can't pass legislation that's going to take thousands of people out of prison. And so, look, I think my gun policy plans are the best. I think that things like gun licensing are supported by 70 to 80% of Americans. I can show you the data that in states like Connecticut that did gun licensing, not only did overall gun violence drop 40%, but suicides, which is another type of gun violence we don't talk about enough in America. Suicides dropped 15%. My job, we just talked about this in a foreign policy context, same in a domestic policy. My job is to protect, as President of the United States, American lives. If I'm in that website as a person who has literally been to too many damn funerals of too many children, I'm going to take real measures to make sure that we as a country raise the consciousness to pass the legislation to protect people, because this is what I know. Talk about how hard it was to pass legislation. Well, I told you, when four girls died in a bombing in Birmingham, raised consciousness, we rallied, we passed legislation. When women, we couldn't pass workers' rights legislation, powerful corporate interest. Well, when women were throwing themselves out windows at the shirtwaist factory fire, we responded. But now this country, when our children are being slaughtered in schools, as you mentioned, mass shootings from Parkland to Newtown, the strongest nation on the planet Earth, where we agree on most of these issues, instead of changing laws, we now send our children to schools with the implicit message that we can't protect you, so we're going to teach you how to hide. There are more shelter-in-place drills in the United States of America in our public schools than fire drills. This is morally unconscionable in our nation. We are better than this, and we know it because 86% of gun owners support some common sense things.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, how can you prove we're better than this if policies have not changed, given all the shootings you refer to?
Because it's a test of leadership. Look, the Parkland students were very effective at calling to the conscience of this country and getting things done. Laws even passed in Florida. So don't I started in Newark with people lining up to tell me all the things we couldn't do, that you can't turn around an urban school system, that Newark has had 60 years of losing population. You can't make this city grow again. My whole career has been running at the toughest of problems. I'm a kid from the suburbs, came out of Yale Law School. I moved into the toughest neighborhood, one of the toughest, most violent neighborhoods in New Jersey.
Are there executive actions you could take as president?
Yeah, of course there are executive actions, but that will make things, could move the bar. But I'm talking about ending the crisis we have in our country, the carnage that in my lifetime, I'm 50 years old, we've had more people die.
I guess, why do you think it's so intractable?
Again, I pointed out to you that at many points in history, we thought things were intractable. The number of times civil rights legislation failed, the number of times suffrage folks failed. Heck, me and Kamala Harris finally, after hundreds of attempts, passed a legislation around lynching. she and I were almost in tears on the Senate floor, finally getting it done. Just because it hasn't been done in the past doesn't mean it can't be done now. We need creative leaders. We're going to take new approaches. I broke a lot of norms when I was mayor of the city of Newark. Brought national attention to issues. Heck, I lived on food stamps. It became a national story to demonstrate the crisis that I have in my community, where people work full-time jobs, longer hours than my parents worked, and they were hardworking people, and still needed to use food stamps at a local grocery store. There are ways leaders can bring attention to issues and motivate change and action that hasn't been done before, and that's what we need in the White House now.
You have called for mandatory gun buybacks. A lot of your fellow presidential candidates have called for voluntary gun buybacks. Why mandatory, Senator Booker? How do you even go about doing that?
Well, this is the thing. And these are the things that often end up drawing us into moments where I've seen in this presidential campaign that are not constructive to mobilizing that change. Because this is a trope on the of that small minority of the people that don't want that still want assault rifles on our streets. And they say, oh, well, people are going to come for my guns. Well, let's wipe that image out of our mind. We had machine guns in the United States of America. We banned them. We found a way to get them off of their streets. As a guy that lives in urban, knows urban violence a lot, we don't see machine guns anymore. Australia got them off of in 2003. We were able to get guns off. There are proven evidence-based ways that we can get these guns off of our streets. I'm going to do that when I'm president of the United States.
Coming up, more of our conversation with New Jersey U.S. Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Cory Booker. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, it's the latest in our presidential primary 2020 candidate forums. And we're talking with Democrat Cory Booker. NHPR's Josh Rogers is also with me. And Senator Booker, I want to turn to what may be the sort of national theme of your campaign, and that's unity, civic grace, saying there's a need for what you call radical love in this country. It's the nice campaign. This message often gets audiences applauding, as you know, but President Trump also gets enthusiastic applause when he makes fun of people, when he says certain groups of Americans are dangerous, that they're enemies of the people. What does this suggest to you, Senator Booker, about the national appetite for your message of civic grace and radical love?
Well, that's what campaigns are testing, and I'm really excited to be in this campaign. We haven't poll tested our messaging, whatever. This is the reason I'm running, is because I do think we need that revival of civic grace in our country. I do think that we are best in our nation when we love each other and recognize that we need each other, that we belong to each other. I love concepts of rugged individualism and self-reliance, but that didn't get us to the moon. It didn't beat the Nazis. We did those things together. In fact, when the Russians put up Sputnik, imagine if that happened now. We'd fall into partisan ranks. No, we joined together. We took hidden figures, put them at the same tables with white male astronauts, and we went to the moon. And so this is, I think this election is a referendum not on one guy in one office. I think this is a referendum on who we are as a people and who we are going to be to each other. And he has clearly showed us who he is. He's the guy that wants to pit Americans against Americans.
And plenty of people are applauding those lines. So how do you reach out to those people who are saying, yeah, enemies of the people?
Well, again,
I'm in a
primary that is going to run in a general election. And the reason why I believe I'm the best candidate to beat Donald Trump, remember, in many swing states, he got less votes than Mitt Romney got. In fact, if Hillary Clinton in just Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, we lost those three states as Democrats by 77,000 votes combined. In the metropolitan area of Milwaukee, there were less than 70,000 less African Americans came out to vote than in 2012. What we first need to do is energize the folks. Remember, King's letters from the Birmingham jail were not to the people that were preaching hate, division, and divisiveness. It was actually challenging good people. His letter was to good folks who were doing nothing. He said so eloquently, what we have to repent for in this day and age is not the vitriolic words and violent actions of bad people, it's the appalling silence and inaction of good people. I'm running because I think that when we excite and energize the best of who we are, we'll see record voter turnouts. We won't just beat Donald Trump. We'll beat Mitch McConnell, because North Carolina, which we lost in 2016, we won it in 2008, and had record turnouts. We had a Democratic senator come from there. Well, I want to pick up that Senate seat in this election. So for me, first and foremost, it's turning to each other. If this is the most important election of our lifetime, we got to act like it. And if this is a test of the spirit of this country, you can't campaign wrong and then govern right. Let's manifest the energy we want right now. Darkness can't drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate can't drive out hate. Only love can do that, as King so eloquently said.
So are you saying energize the people who may agree with your message and just set aside those Trump voters who are cheering for that more divisive message?
Well, there's an analog to this. I'm the only person that can say this in this election. I fought against a powerful machine. I had death threats. A federal judge, Faith Hochberg, warned me about my safety. I had my phones tapped. The police, my campaign office is broken into, police being used, bullying, powerful people going against me. There's an Oscar-nominated movie.
I've heard you talk about
that. Yes, called Street Fight. You want to talk about a fighter and how to fight? Please watch that movie. Lost in the Oscars to March of the Dagnab Penguins. but it is.
Penguins are cute.
You're saying I'm not? Oh my gosh, Laura. I've never been insulted by someone on NPR before. look. You can win with grace and dignity. That's what civil rights activists showed. You can win with grace and dignity. That's what suffragettes showed. In fact, that's the only way to beat. We didn't beat Bull Connor because we brought bigger dogs and bigger fire hoses. So I think Americans are yearning for that kind of message. And how I know here in New Hampshire they are, the head of the Democratic Party took me out and said, the very beginning, don't change your message. Let's give you a little advice. Don't change your message.
And I go, the nice guy.
And he said, you know why? In the last time there was a big competitive field, there was this underdog guy polling at 1% a few days. It was after a horrible president named Nixon, and the country was yearning for decency and goodness. And Jimmy Carter came in here to New Hampshire, real underdog, talked about the decency we need in our society, talked about our values from him coming from his deep-seated faith. And he upset here in New Hampshire and went on to the presidency.
Well, I know Josh has a couple questions for you about that, but one last question on this. So Democratic voters, as you know, Senator Booker, want more than anything a nominee who can win. So what's your message to those who might think you're too nice, you're too loving, you have too much civic grace to beat Donald Trump? You know, Trevor Noah said, what does that mean? Like Donald Trump, you know, punches you and you hug him? I mean, what does that mean?
It's how we
always... Are you strong enough, tough enough to go against the president?
Watch Street Fight. I beat one the most powerful machine in Newark with these kind of ideals. I've taken on the toughest battles and won because that's how you win. The people my parents told me to look up to, who took on the strongest empire on the planet Earth at that time, a bald guy, love his haircut, but he's a giant. And in fact, his picture was on Martin Luther King's wall, a guy named Gandhi. We are best in America. We are a good, decent nation. And let me just give you this clear point. In New Jersey, for example, there was an election that should have coincided with Chris Christie's re-election. Chris Christie had the flexibility to set my election because it was a special election, so he moved it 3 weeks earlier on a Wednesday. Now, what happened to turnout? That's how you win elections. And especially, again, we cannot win this election unless black and brown communities turn out at record levels. We learned that the hard way in the last election. I was the only person in a race on a Wednesday election. 3 weeks later, people up and down the ballot. The African-American turnout in my state, when I was on the ballot, spiked up between 13% and 14%. 3 weeks later, on a regular election, it dropped between 9% and 10%.
Okay.
If I'm on the ballot, I'm the best person to revive the Obama coalition, to beat Donald Trump, but not just there, to beat Mitch McConnell. And remember, beating Donald Trump is a floor. I'm looking for to get to the ceiling. I'm looking to get to the mountaintop. The way we do that is by healing this country, bringing people together, uncommon coalitions to produce the uncommon results we need.
All right. Go ahead. Back to you, Josh.
All right. I want to turn to, you know, what for Democrats is kind of an uncommon coalition, your historic backing for school choice policies when it comes to education. I know that charter schools are big in Newark due to your backing in large part. But through the years, you've favored tax credits, funded scholarship programs, at times straight up voucher programs. You at one time served on the board of an educational choice organization with Betsy DeVos, which is certainly a rare credential for a Democratic presidential candidate these days. How important do you believe school choice should be in America's educational philosophy?
Well, let's just put it this way. First and foremost, if you are really driven on serving children, you should look at all options, explore whatever possibly works. You look at Elizabeth Warren's book during the same time that I was exploring all options. She was talking about vouchers as a potential option as well. She and I both are against them now. When I was living where I don't think any other presidential candidates ever lived, and where I've decided my entire professional life to live in a community below the poverty line, where we don't confuse wealth with worth, my children have the same worth and potential as wealthy neighborhoods. And I was living in high-rise projects and saw the anguish of parents, this is back in the 90s, desperate for their children to find a great school, and the ones in our community were the lowest performing in our state. So heck yeah, I looked at every option possible. But I'll tell you what, my very experience with other Democrats who joined with Republicans to look at solutions on that board where Betsy DeVos was there, as well as other urban Democrats, my experience on that board with her was one of the reasons why I was one of the biggest champions in fighting against her on the Senate floor. Because I knew when she got in, she would go after the very communities that I first chose to represent, which is gutting the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Education and stopping the predictions that Obama started to do about everything from the school-to-prison pipeline to LGBTQ kids. So let's talk about the education policy that I actually implemented when one of the few people in this race, I think Michael Bennett might be the only other person, that actually took responsibility for running a challenged school district, him in Denver, me in Newark. Well, the very first thing we did, and I think this is one of the reasons why my state's largest teachers union endorsed me twice, is we said the people, the professionals in our public schools should be paid well. So they're not like we see in America right now, where so many teachers are making tough decisions about how to pay their rent and their student loans, and yet they're still these incredible people that reach in their pockets to pay for the things that their children need when they show up without. So one thing we did in Newark, which I'm gonna do, is raise teacher salaries. And not just teachers, all the school professionals that are essential, from school therapists to speech pathologists and others. Number two is we found out in Newark that we had a disproportionate, as often low-income neighbors do, high numbers of special needs kids. And I just was in a community before I came out here in Iowa, where rural district, where the guy told me 20-25% of their budget is to take care of our beautiful children with special needs. And I told him, well, my plan is to fully fund special education. And he looked at me pretty excited, because as some people here are applauding, which is that would bring for individual schools millions of dollars to help them not only to educate our beautiful special needs kids, but to do the kind of things to give a school community environment where children have the resources they need. We found out in Newark practical things work, but let's talk about public charter schools. I was a guy in my state that fought against charter schools opening in many communities because they would have hurt the public schools. In Newark, New Jersey, we closed bad charter schools because they weren't serving our children.
But so how's your, I mean, I guess my question is, how's your thinking on this issue, or how would you characterize the way in which it's changed? Because, you know, you can go and find video clips of you on YouTube sounding like an evangelist for school choice without reservation, and people can change their views based on their experience. What, in your experience, has convinced you that, you know, charter schools may not be what you once claimed they could be for students?
Oh, well, please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. In Newark, we have thriving charter schools that I unequivocally, unapologetically support. They are educating black and brown kids and giving them, and frankly, we held them to standards. The public charter schools should hold up to public standards. They have to take the numbers of special needs kids. They can't cream. There's a one enrollment system in Newark. And this is why when I listen to other people on the debate stage and say they're coming after charters, I was like, well, you're going to have to come through me. Because I'm not taking away the schools that work for low-income kids, often in an urban context. But I watch what's going on in this state, and I've seen charter laws that Republicans are trying to do that are far more about hurting the public school system and that just make no sense. So again, this is a much more complicated and nuanced issue than black and white, and we shouldn't have some kind of just rhetorical purity tests when it comes to what works for local communities.
Is that frustrating for you as somebody who's been involved with this issue? This is obviously not something you talk about unbidden out there, because it's not a way to get votes in a Democratic primary.
Look, I care about people. I care about my children. In Newark, our graduation rate is now spiked up 30%. Our schools are now outperforming suburban wealthy districts. We're now the number one school system in all of America for beat the odds schools, kids going from poverty to college. And so my point to you is, I didn't get into politics to play politics. I got in politics to find ways that serve people. When the big education bill was going through, and thank God we were unwinding the No Child Left Behind, over-testing, everything like that, the rush and the energy was going towards just pulling the federal government out. I had to fight with some Democrats or talk to some Democrats because I want vulnerable children to have success. So I ended up going to a Republican, right-wing Republican, whose office I go to study, do Bible study, because Brené Brown said it's hard to hate up close to pull people in. And I noticed on this guy's a shelf, I'm talking about Jim Inhofe, there was a black girl. I was curious to be a framed picture of a black girl on this guy who we might think a right-wing Republican, we might have stereotypes to think that wouldn't be a picture he would have prominently on his plate. I asked him about her. It's his granddaughter, adopted. And so when that big education bill was coming by, I said, this is the guy I want to work with on forcing states to disaggregate their data for minorities, for homeless kids, for foster kids, so we can actually hold people accountable for results. I know this is a complicated nuanced policy, but he co-sponsored my amendment. It is now the law of our land. I don't care fundamentally, I'm in this. The reason why I've stayed in a low-income community below the poverty line, the reason why I missed Virginia Jones, my tenant president, who pushed me into politics but told me stay in the community so that every day I get up, and whether it's a shooting on my block, whether it's the drug treatment center across my street, I live with the everyday urgency, not to be loyalty to partisan purity tests, but to be loyal to driving results for the people that the politics doesn't often serve.
Senator Booker, I also want to ask you about housing. Clearly, education, very important issue for you. You talk a lot about housing in your campaign. You often tell the story, and it's a pretty amazing story, about the legal battle your parents had to wage in order to buy a good home in a good neighborhood. They had help from the Fair Housing Council, others. Your family won, but it was tough. And you often say, Senator Booker, that growing up in that home changed the course of your life. So housing, very important to you. Let's talk a little bit about some of your policies. We could talk forever about all of them, but I want to ask you a couple questions. You've said that removing local roadblocks to creating affordable
housing
is critical.
Let me just say something. Because this race is really unfortunate. Like Julian Castro dropping out, he and I have had long conversations. Former housing secretary. Before even New Hampshire or Iowa have even had a chance to vote or caucus. I mean, these are the kind of things about losing the diversity, the only Latino in this race. His voice is what makes us a weaker race, and these are the kind of things that frustrate me. But my experience as a housing activist from the time I started as a lawyer are reasons why, and my sophisticated nuances, I know we're not going to get into all my policy plans, but this is why it's so urgent that I feel like my voice is so important in this race, so important to be, thankfully, hopefully, in the White House, people with lived experiences about the housing struggles of so many Americans.
Well, I know Josh, a little bit later, has some questions about the declining diversity of the Democratic field. So for sure, we'll cover that.
Yes.
One interesting aspect of your affordable housing plan, Senator Booker, that I wanted to ask you about, you said that you would tie federal infrastructure dollars to what you call demonstrated progress on housing. Removing those local roadblocks, and we've certainly seen a lot of discussion about this in New Hampshire. How far are you willing to go with this, Senator Booker, denying cities or towns federal money because they don't show enough progress on housing?
So understand this.
How would that work?
Yeah, I will explain it very bluntly, but just the larger theory behind this case. It was federal dollars that incentivized a whole bunch of practices that not only worked against low-income people, that drove a lot of the racial disparities we see in America right now. Remember, FHA, overtly racist policies, redlining, mortgage loaning, all of these things have done in our past that were funded by federal streams of dollars to create what I consider the distraught present we have around housing issues in America.
So the federal government has already played this game on one end.
Right.
You're saying you'd like to play it on the other end.
Exactly. Now to incentivize the better practices. Same thing with criminal justice. Federal money going in to incentivize building prisons and all this stuff. So it's common sense. Let's start having the federal government incentivize local communities to change discriminatory zoning practices, to use local dollars to change patterns and practices that are against building affordable housing. We have a housing crisis. It may not be talked about enough in this presidential primary, but this is one of the greatest pain points for America.
Well, we certainly talk a lot about it in New Hampshire. So I'm wondering, Senator Booker, like, can you give me a for example? Concord, New Hampshire feels like it's doing some progress on affordable housing. You, President Booker, feel like it's not enough. So,
What do you do? I'm not pointing fingers at Concord.
No, I'm just using that as an example.
I will tell you, I know, but I want to just talk specifically about how I'm going to help New Hampshireites, Granite Staters, to actually have more affordable housing. The biggest pillar of my plan is to put housing folks in the same position we put homeowners, which is to say, simply for homeowners, we are going to use our tax dollars to help homeowners by giving them mortgage interest deduction. Most of that, by the way, is used by Americans that have in the top 3 or 4% of American earners. That's who mostly use a mortgage interest deduction. So why don't renters get the same investment from our tax code? So my plan simply says, if you are a renter in New Hampshire that is paying more than a third of your income in rent, then you should get a tax credit. 82,000 families in this state would get about $4,000 more in their pocket to help them afford their rent. It's a very powerful way to make a difference, and we can pay for it just by reversing these toxic Trump tax cuts.
We will talk a lot more with New Jersey Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Cory Booker in just a moment. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our series of primary 2020 candidate forums continues with Democratic presidential candidate and U.S. Senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker. NHPR's Josh Rogers is also with me for the hour. And Josh, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, Senator, a moment ago you mentioned your disappointment that Secretary Castro was out of the race and your concern that what it has been the most diverse Democratic field ever is, getting smaller and whiter. you know, Andrew Yang wrote to the DNC chairman Perez asking that, you know, commissions more polls so he makes sure that, in his words, a diverse set of candidates might be absent from the stage in Des Moines for reasons out of anyone's control. It's a troubling prospect. You know, do you think the interests of the country are well served by the combination of having New Hampshire and Iowa go first, two very white states, and the DNC rules? I mean, what's your sense? You obviously have concerns that without a lot of, you know, if you put it, black and brown voters, Democrats will lose. Do you think the way system has been set up is a problem?
You know, I was here in the Granite State with NAACP leaders, a bunch of African Americans, Latinos, met with them the other night, and people expressed distress that, you know, you see somebody like Kamala Harris, who's twice elected, the second black woman ever in the United States Senate, twice elected by a state of 40 million people, who was running a good campaign, is not in this race anymore simply because she didn't have money. Well, there's people on the stage or in this race who are billionaires who can just pay their way. Are we creating a system in the Democratic Party where our party decries the influence of billionaires and millionaires on our political system, dark money and all that, but yet we've created a primary system that before voters even have to say, money is determining who gets to the primaries? Andrew Yang is right. Look, we haven't had an early state poll, qualifying poll, since early November. There's been two debates. Candidates have dropped out. This race has shifted, but we haven't had an early state qualifying poll. If you did one right now in these multiple states, I'm confident that Andrew and I would be on the stage. And that's the frustrating thing for us, is that these are artificial barriers that were never before in our process. And the thing that's insane about this that has made me – I used to have this big afro at the beginning of this campaign. I've pulled it all out. the thing that's made this difficult for me is the fact that, you know, what we've seen in the past is people who have been polling very low throughout the campaign on the national polls – who come in the end, surge, and become our presidents. Carter in the single digits. Bill Clinton at 4%. Barack Obama on the national polls going into Iowa, he was still 15, 20 points behind Hillary Clinton. Yet we're basing the debate stage on these national polls. Let me go even further than that. 1 month before the Iowa caucuses, John Kerry and John Edwards were polling at 4% and 2%. It was going to be the Howard Dean show. My campaign manager sent me the article. It's hilarious reading this now in the back of history. Sharpton was ahead of those two guys. I can go through all the people. They were polling 6th and 7th. 1 month later, in the Iowa caucuses, they finished 1st and 2nd. This state loves the upset. You guys love people who are polling behind, but come here, as Bill Clinton called himself, the comeback kid. So why are we creating in Washington, D.C., the DNC leadership is creating new barriers that are preventing people. In Iowa right now, I'm the number third person in net favorability, third most popular candidate in the state. We in Iowa and New Hampshire are in the top three in endorsements from the people that you've elected, your local leaders.
Sure, sure. I mean, you know, you rightly point to the precedent you cite, but it's also true that you, more than many of your rivals, have done what you're allegedly supposed to do well in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
You used to campaign up here for other Democrats. You helped the Democratic Party with money. You know, have come early and often. You've been crashing at people's houses.
Yeah.
you know, you've got a lot of endorsements.
Yes, sir.
But you know, there's still a perception, you know, and I guess we'll see if that perception is accurate when people vote,
yeah,
that your campaign is foundering a bit. And
yeah,
I guess my question is like, what does that say about the models that we have in terms of,
yeah,
what works here and what is allegedly important?
The models of national polls have never predicted who would become president. In fact, if you look, you know.
But in state polls, you're not exactly tearing it up.
No, but again, we have local press came last night. They couldn't believe the crowd we had, hundreds of people. We are, and by the way, there hasn't been a qualifying state poll since early November. A lot has changed in this race. Kamala dropping out, Bullock dropping out, now Castro dropping out. So this race has shifted. And by every measure of what it takes to win in the Granite State, as you've just gone through, we are showing that kind of success. And why are your state senators and state reps endorsing us at higher levels than most every other campaign? It's because they know our message and our capabilities to win and beat Donald Trump is great. So I just don't want the Granite State, like they did last time, last debate, not to have a set of options of the most competitive races that are going on in the Granite State. There are people that are saying, I'm pulling out. I'm not even campaigning here.
It's been a while since you were here before this week. I know you were sick once.
Missed my last one because I was lying prostrate on my bathroom floor. There are times in your life that the cold tile of your bathroom floor is the greatest place on earth. Look, any measures you just said, we are doing well here. I'm in it to win it. We hope that more people will go to corybooker.com because the surge in online donations that we've had has been incredible. They've helped us to do what the billionaires in the race are doing, which is start to go up on TV. And so we are in this to win it. We are following a well-worn pathway of other people who are considered long shots who came here to this state in an upset.
But just directly on the question of diversity in Iowa and New Hampshire, do you think that's a problem?
I think that Iowa was the first state to make Obama a winner and send the first black president to the White House. I think as long as you have South Carolina in February as well and Nevada in February as well, that combination is really good. And I'm going to say something else tactically for us, and it's just as a black guy, I know this. You know, like so many other communities in the Democratic Party coalition, black folks are worried and know that this president, for a lot of these issues, it's life or death for communities of color. And so, you know what? For Obama, they didn't believe. They loved him, but he was well behind in South Carolina until he showed he could win in a majority white state. And as soon as that caucus was over, he became shot up like a lightning bolt. So we know that when the first caucus happens, that's our proving ground. And when we upset there, and we're going to upset there, that's going to be when really the gun goes off to this race, because we're going to see the candidates that have the kind of muster. The same way I beat a political machine in Newark on the ground, grassroots campaigning, same way I did in this state last night, hundreds of people showing up. That's how we're going to upset. And by the way, the polls in Newark would have never predicted my rise in that city. They would have said I had no shot in my elections.
Senator Booker, I want to ask you about criminal justice reform. You say you have the best record on this issue than anyone in the race. You have a lot of plans. So in the interest of time, I'll just ask you about one of them.
Yes.
Regarding marijuana offenses, Senator Booker, you'd say as president you'd expunge the records of those convicted of marijuana crimes. Would you also support legalizing marijuana at the federal level?
I mean, that's part of my major bill, and I came out early on for this. I'm so happy.
So the whole country.
No. I don't have the power to do that as a president. Let's not be clear. So I introduced something that shook a lot of people. Even Democrats said things to me. Now everybody's coming along, called the Marijuana Justice Act.
So expunging the records.
Well, that's important because we should not talk about legalization of marijuana without expunging records. And just an important data point. Remember, 2017, more marijuana arrests in this country than violent crime arrests combined. So we have kids that are having their lives destroyed, can't get jobs, can't get loans from banks, can't get housing for doing things that two of the last three presidents admitted to doing. This is enough and is enough. I'm going to deschedule marijuana on the federal level. That's a technical thing that the federal government can do, making it legal on the federal level, allowing states to do what they want. But I'm not stopping there. In the same way that we incentivized the drug war from the federal level, if you're a state, haven't legalized marijuana, but your drug enforcement is on the face biased. Remember, there's no difference between blacks and whites for using marijuana or selling marijuana, but blacks are four times more likely to be arrested for it. This has driven an unconscionable reality in our country in recent decades, where there are now more African Americans under criminal supervision than all the slaves in 1850. If you're a state that your drug enforcement policies, like this state, are overtly having a racial impact, then we are in the federal level are going to do things with our flexible streams of dollars to incentivize you to change practices to bring racial justice to your criminal justice system.
So can you explain to me how that works, Senator Booker? So you would say any state can legalize marijuana if it wants, but you're not legalizing it nationally? I'm not quite clear on what you're suggesting.
So the federal
there.
Government cannot tell you in your state.
It can't tell New Hampshire.
It can't tell New Hampshire. We couldn't tell you what your – I just learned this from somebody at the ACLU forum. Couldn't tell you what your drinking age could be. But you know why the drinking age in the state went up?
Federal highway dollars.
Federal highway dollars. So I can't tell you to legalize marijuana. But if you're arresting blacks in this state at four times the rate of whites for a crime that has no difference in the racial disparities, just like John F. Kennedy, just like Lyndon Johnson, who went into many southern states that were having racial impacts in their legislation, they use the federal government to leverage change on the state level. We have a terrible system in America where we incarcerate vulnerable people. As Brian Stevenson says, we have a nation that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Here in New Hampshire, around our country, we over-incarcerate the mentally ill. We over-incarcerate the drug addicted, people that need help and treatment. What we do to women in prison is unconscionable. There are practices that violate human rights, violate our economic well-being by taking a parent away from a child for a nonviolent drug crime and maybe even addiction instead of helping them We now put them back on the streets where they now have a nonviolent conviction, and it hurts their economic well-being and their children's. We need to get out of this punitive sort of a retribution criminal justice system and embrace the ideas of restorative justice. And so, yeah, I'm going to use federal authority to make sure that our justice system is doing what even some southern states have done, radically lowered their prison populations. And guess what's also gone down? Their crime has gone down as well. Because I found it in Newark when we started the state's first ever Office of Reentry, that if you help people coming out of prison get jobs, get housing, get back on their feet, they don't go back into prison.
That's often an issue. They get out, they can't find housing jobs, yes, and they reoffend.
So we have a system that we would much rather spend more money on the back end of problems than make the critical strategic investments on the front end to make ourselves safer, to empower human potential and human dignity.
Well, lots more we could talk about on criminal justice for sure. Big yes. issue for you, but I want to throw it back to you, Josh.
Go ahead. I want to turn to impeachment, Senator. You know, you and your Senate colleagues who are running for the Oval Office are in kind of an odd position. You're running for president as you prepare to be a juror.
I've been called odd before, but continue.
Well, I mean, we can enumerate more ways. But back in October, you told NPR that, quote, history will look back and say, what did the United States Senate, what did Congress do when a president of the United States was acting more like a dictator or totalitarian authoritarian leader than someone who's subject to the checks and balances as designed by our founders? That was back in October. Last month on Meet the Press, you said that this, meaning the impeachment trial, is just not a good thing for America. What I want to understand is, how should the public understand your thinking and on the impeachment, and has it changed?
Oh, not at all. Those two, that statement was a little out of context, so I want to explain because they're good. Both the same statement. It is not good for America that a president has violated his oath of office. We shouldn't be having partisan glee about him being impeached. This is sad. It is a sad day for America that we've seen the third president in our history impeached. It's just not a good thing. I don't take partisan glee out of this. I wish he didn't do what he did. I wish that we were focused on beating him in November. So let's understand what that statement was, which is just simply, I'm sorry, I'm not taking glee on this moment. It is a sad, sobering moment, but we must do our duty. History will look back on this moment to say, what did we do? Do we just turn our heads and say, let's just wait till the next election? No, there are important checks and balances. A president of the United States should not be allowed to use his position for his own personal benefit to compromise what is in what both parties have said is in the national security interest of the United States of America. I've been to the Ukraine. I've been to the Donbass region. I've met with our soldiers and their soldiers. I saw the difference that American help was making to save lives. And this president was withholding that in order to leverage help for his own political campaign. That's ridiculous, and it's wrong. And we must make sure that we don't send a message to future presidents that behavior is okay.
So given what you just said, do you need to know more, or do you think the evidence is out there and you can?
Oh, please. This is, again, one of those moments where I don't understand. You literally are about to have a trial where the key witnesses are not going to be there. We could exonerate. If you're so innocent, Mr. President, then have the people that were in the room, like your acting chief of staff, testify, swear under oath, testify to what he saw, what he heard, and what happened. This is so unfair to the American people who deserve the truth, to have the key people not testifying as witnesses in this trial. Again, another example of how this president and Mitch McConnell now, who's openly saying that when I swear that oath that's in the Constitution, there's another oath all of us are going to swear, that basically says we're going to be impartial. He's basically saying, I'm going to lie because I'm going to work in lockstep with this president to get this thing in and out of the Senate as quickly as possible and just sweep it under the rugs. That's unfortunate. Mitch McConnell should be standing up and saying, I am a United States senator in a body that's supposed to hold the president accountable. And Mr. President, if you say you're innocent, bring those people into this office and into this body and let them swear under oath and say what happened. We all should have an interest in the truth.
So, given what you just said, Senator Booker, can we expect you to be that impartial juror as a U.S. senator? Because you're basically using language that makes it sound like you've already decided.
Well, again, I've seen a lot. We've seen a lot in the American public. And more comes out. I woke up this morning early to listen to news about obviously what's happening in Iraq and what happened with the Soleimani assassination. And I start seeing more evidence coming out, these confidential papers that New York Times has, these redacted documents that show even more evidence that, that officials all around Donald Trump were saying this is wrong, what you're saying are lies. These are people in his administration. So the evidence is pretty damning, but I can be a juror now to listen to the evidence presented and objectively make a decision about what is right and what is wrong.
So could you potentially vote the other way?
Look,
it sounds like you've already decided.
No, definitely not. Let Mick Mulvaney come in. Let the Secretary of State come in. Let Barr come in. Sincerely, they were there. Let them provide, because if anybody can tell you about miscarriages of justice as an African-American man in America, I have firsthand experience with people getting where all the evidence once seemed, but you have exonerating witnesses come in. The Innocence Project is another great testimony that we make mistakes. I'm sorry. I'm going to go in there with an open mind, but I'm going to weigh all the evidence, a lot of which has already come out in the House of Representatives. So I can be objective. And let me tell you, just as a guy, and forgive me if this sounds like a little bit of testosterone, and it probably is too much testosterone, so forgive me for saying that early in the morning, but I'm tired, and this is just going to come out.
Just go with it.
I am so looking forward to the moment on the debate stage where Donald Trump tries to invade my personal space. I want to be able to look down on that person and let him know that I stand for truth, I stand for justice, I stand for love, and that we are going to beat you in an election. I would love to do that, but right now he has brought us to an impeachment and we have to do our duty.
Well, Senator Booker, we could have talked a lot more. We really appreciate your time today.
We could have discussed
many more issues. Thank you for being with us. Josh, thank you also for being here. Thanks to our wonderful audience. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.